Hello, I'm Cathy MacDonald. Welcome to Highlights from Sunday Morning from BBC Radio Scotland. For more information on our terms of use, just head for bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland. My first guest is a writer, designer, yoga teacher and physical therapist. Raised as a Mormon, he was travelling to the Himalayas to find his Anglo-Indian relatives when he had a transformative meeting with a Nepalese shaman. This experience led him to confront his own personal demons, helping him to find answers on how to live a better life, all of which he documents in his book Limitless Sky. A very warm welcome to David Charles Manners. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Cathy. Thank you very much.
Not at all. Our pleasure indeed. Tell me, first of all, what took you to Nepal?
Well, it was actually to India, to the Nepalese border. The reason is both my parents' families have long connections to India. Therefore, my childhood was really dominated by tales of life on the subcontinent. And it wasn't actually until my 20s that I was able to make the journey. And it was to a place I felt was home, even though I'd never actually seen it. And it had such an impact on my life, that very first journey, that my life really has been divided ever since by before and after India. And as a result, I now return to India at least once a year, as I have done for the last 21 years.
And of course, as I said, you were seeking your Anglo-Indian relatives, and
yes.
Quite a few of them too.
Quite a few. Yes, I think it was 38 at the time, but that's now increased. There's a new generation arriving.
Wonderful. And while you were there, now you met a shaman, as most of us would probably understand that term, or Jankri. Can you explain what a Jankri is and what it is he does? Because I presume that 10 times out of 10 it's a man.
Well, yes, I mean, the Nepalese word Jankri is for a man, but there are Jankrini, which are the female version, actually. And the word itself actually means very rare, but it also has the meaning of one who peeks in and out. And this refers to their remarkable insight, their wisdom. And in the foothills of the northeast of India, these Jankrini and Jankrini take the role of not only the traditional teacher, but also the village physician, the local councillor, the mediator also, if you like.
I'd like to find out more about your background before returning to your time in Nepal, especially about your family affiliation with the Mormon Church, which apparently goes back four generations. Starting off with what being a Mormon meant for your family, for you and your family.
Well, for my family, I respect their belief system. It supports them in very many ways, which I respect. But for me, growing up, it was a source of extreme conflict. It wasn't simply struggles that I had with aspects of its scripture and doctrine, particularly what I felt, even as a young child, the nature of the God I was expected to obey, with his ever-ready threats of destruction and eternal damnation. I struggled with that hugely, especially when the same God was asking me to love my neighbour, for example. And I never felt I really got the answers that I wanted to my questions. It was always the blanket, go away and pray about it, which was never very satisfactory. But my principal conflict with my family's religion was really from that, as early as I can remember, I've always known exactly who I wanted to love and be loved by, which their religion couldn't and still cannot possibly tolerate. So I was sent to church therapists. I was even exorcised with the laying on of hands to deliver me of the corrupting demon that had obviously possessed me. I was also fed an awful lot of goat's cheese, because for some reason it was considered the most masculinizing of dairy products.
This was all because you knew you were gay.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. And there was the principal conflict that could find no resolution, of course, within their religious structure.
Was there anyone with whom you could share your thoughts, your concerns about how the church and the church hierarchy would react?
Not at the time. No, my world was very small. It was entirely Mormon dominated. And there was never really, I never felt there was much encouragement to explore the world beyond the boundaries of the church. And therefore, when there were moments when I felt out of real desperation, because by the age of 14 I was suicidal with this conflict that I had, when I did try to confess, really, is what was what the church would require, of course the reaction was one of great drama every time. So no, I didn't feel that I could explore my feelings at any point with anybody that I could trust to actually listen.
And you were a missionary, Amy, you became a missionary. For those who don't know what that involves, can you explain what that meant?
Yeah. Well, Mormonism is an evangelical religion. In fact, it was impressed on me growing up that the only reason to befriend or even interact with a non-Mormon was to find a way to convert them. And so it's a driving force in the Mormon church. There's the expectation that at 19 years old, every Mormon boy will be sent away from his family for 2 years, where he's expected to live like a monk and is assigned a companion come moral guardian and is expected to spend pretty much every waking hour knocking on doors in search of potential converts. I was sent away to Pennsylvania, and in a way it was a magical, I mean, very, very tough experience, one I wouldn't want to repeat. But it was magical for me because I was sent up to the North Pennsylvania, which was Amish country. And because I could speak German to some degree, the Mennonite families we were meeting were actually an absolute joy because I could speak to them without my companion knowing what I was saying.
So that must have been liberating in a sense. What did you talk to them about? Did you tell them things that you didn't want your companion to know about?
Absolutely. I never once mentioned the church to start with. I wanted to know about their life, and I was so intrigued by them. I mean, they are extraordinary to see in their horse traps and their 18th century clothing. And they had a beautiful simplicity about them, which I found immensely attractive.
And did you feel that that was a more comfortable fit, if you like? Because I sense that you were fortunate in many ways. Your education was kind of very international. And then, of course, you talk about being fluent in German. It was something you could speak at the time. You were in Philadelphia. Although you were, the constraints of the church were there too, the Mormon church. But in many ways, it allowed you to explore other cultures, other ways of life, I suppose.
It did. The Amish particularly. That, for me, was a revelation that there might be other ways of living that could suit me better. But, of course, I mean, the Amish are fundamentalist in their own way, and therefore there'd be no room as a young gay man to explore my truth within that structure. But certainly the simplicity of their lives was immensely attractive.
Eventually, you left, or rather you were excommunicated, weren't you, by the church?
I was.
How old? 21 years of age. That must have been hard and affecting you deeply.
It was. I think it's hard to describe to those who've not known the strictures of a fundamentalist background the significance of excommunication. This is undertaken by a church court. It's a sentence decreed by a church court in which there's a jury, there are prosecutors and a defence who are there to stand in moral judgment and, they believe, make a pronouncement on behalf of God. And this was simply because I had dared to follow my heart. And this, of course, was in defiance of what is an extremely strict stance of the Mormon church. It was very hard for my family, as you might imagine, because of their belief, particularly, that families are bound together for eternity. Therefore, according to their beliefs, I am now lost to them, which, of course, is very painful. But for me, excommunication was undoubtedly a liberation. However, it wasn't really until I met the Jagri and began to explore the teachings that he was offering that I was finally able to really begin to free my mind and my heart from the pain of that long and difficult background.
But it was an incredible price to pay, wasn't it? To lose your family, if you like, and to know that for them to stay within the Mormon family, their family, it meant that you could not be reconciled.
Yes, but I must say that they are... I love my family very much, and I'm devoted to them, and I know they are to me also. Therefore, they have been extremely compassionate and understanding, and although I continue to see struggles that they have with who I am, they have never actively been unkind, I must say.
Now, when you were in Nepal and you were learning the wisdom from your shaman or Jankri, did any of what you learned help you reflect back on your Mormon upbringing?
Very much, actually. It really was the process of exploring the practicality of his teachings that I really undid the pain of that past. It also helped me to recognise some of the positive and useful things my background had actually given me, such as self-discipline, which undoubtedly a Mormon upbringing teaches you. But the Jankri's teachings, the most significant thing perhaps, was the way he taught me to recognise and then resolve the conflicts between my conscience and my outer life, supporting me to be honest enough with myself to find how to live according to my heart and no longer according to other people's minds, this other background that I had.
There's a great sense of independence about you too, David. I sense that from the book, and a fearlessness. I wonder if that is part of surviving with all these secrets, I suppose, in a community that wouldn't understand what you were trying share with them, if you like, or hide from them.
Yes, very much so. I think when you grow up, especially from a very young age, I mean, I knew exactly who I was, what my heart was when I was 5 years old. That's the earliest that I can remember knowing that for myself. Therefore, to grow up in that environment, that religious environment, meant great isolation, which, of course, to survive it, it demands a great level of self-reliance. And yes, that has served me well, undoubtedly.
And that could also have worked against you, though, in many ways. Is it something that has changed for you, this wisdom and this philosophy that you acquired with Kushal Magar? Do you think that has changed you from the person you were, this independent, soul-searching young man, if you like?
It supported the real me, undoubtedly. But also, another thing, just thinking about that from your question, something that it really has really required change, and it was a difficult change. I mean, these teachings are not easy. They're confrontational, really. They ask the individual to examine who we think we are. And one of the significant things for me was his teaching that I was to learn to do, say, and think nothing to my detriment or the detriment of another. Now, whilst this idea of not doing ill to others is fundamental to all the main religions, the idea of not doing anything to my detriment seemed a wholly new idea. That was not something that I had been taught growing up. Mm-hmm. And it was immensely difficult, but has proved one of the greatest gifts, actually, that he gave me.
David, I want to go back to your time in Nepal and your experiences with Jankri, Kushal Magar. You were for many years his apprentice, and I believe that you, as we kind of touched on, undertook a few extreme initiations, one of which taps into all of my insecurities in one go, involving staying in a dark cave with a blindfold for 5 days. Explain what happened and just how you felt about it at the time.
Yes, well, this initiations in caves are actually quite common in various traditions, including the Tibetan Buddhist tradition up in those hills. This was very extraordinary and very difficult, I can't deny, but my head was wrapped tightly in thick cloth. So not only were my eyes bound, but my hearing was also deadened. I was then left alone, as you said, and food was delivered only when I slept, so there was never any opportunity for interaction. This, as you can well imagine, provoked all sorts of irrational fears and intense claustrophobia at times. But what I hadn't anticipated was that when the optic nerve is suddenly starved of stimulation, the image-hungry brain begins to seemingly project the workings of the subconscious right in front of you in vivid technicolor. And the purpose of this is to steadily expose the true background noise, the filter, if you like, through which we live our ordinary daily lives. So all my fears, my obsessions, the difficult memories that I carried with me, resentment, regret, guilt, all those sorts of anxieties were rather brutally exposed to me with a blindfold on. And of course, these are the things that constantly determine our self-image, even though we're not particularly aware of them all the time. But also the way it determines the way we interact with others and the way we respond to life's challenges. So whilst it was undoubtedly an alarming experience at times, it also was a transformative revelation, and things were never quite the same again.
And thankfully, or otherwise, he had been feeding you some strange brew, which you later discovered was quite potent.
Very potent. Again, that's very much part of the Jayakri tradition. They have an extraordinary number of medicinal plants, many of which have psychotropic properties. And, of course, they're absolute experts in making extraordinary concoctions. And yes, that was how, for me, the process began, when he began to feed me very delicious spicy tea.
Were you ever afraid?
Very much so. Absolutely. Every imaginable fear, from spiders to murderers, I mean, all tigers, you know, all of it came flooding through. Which, of course, is the point. It's to expose those deep, dark fears that we carry around and very rarely admit to ourselves or confront. But in those conditions, you actually have to face the darker, hidden depths of your psyche.
You place so much trust in Kushal. By this time, were you quite confident that no harm would come to you? Or were you still struggling? Were you just taking a chance, if you like, and hoping that what he wanted to do to you was going to result in something that was better than the person who'd come seeking some sort of, to fill some sort of yawning chasm in their life?
Yes. I mean, there were many moments of doubt with regards to what he was saying to me and asking, offering me as opportunities to explore. And I had many questions, which I think you mentioned in the book. I had many questions for him. And there were times that I thought that he was completely insane, and perhaps that I was too. However, these more extreme personal tests, these initiations, came later on in the process, by which time I had grown to know and trust him and the tradition that he was sharing, which had already by this time proven its worth to me in the way that it was markedly changing my self-image and my life and my relationships for the better.
Another initiation involved spending the night with a dead body, which sounds bad enough, but actually you were encouraged, if I can say that, but not forced to touch it. And
yes,
and so to be aware that you were spending time with somebody who had just died.
Yes, a very extraordinary, intense experience, which is very difficult to put into words. And actually writing that chapter took me a great deal of time and even tears, to be honest. It was a very extreme experience. Now, the purpose of it was to confront me with that one inescapable reality that most of us, especially me, spend our time trying to avoid, that we will all eventually die. And whilst this may sound macabre, it was actually remarkably life-affirming. For example, having your hands on a body that is not breathing for hours does nothing but intensify the fact that you are breathing. Never had I known myself so alive as I did that night. And it was a fact that became and has remained absolutely wondrous to me. The morning when the dawn broke, when that initiation came to its end, I vowed that I would never waste a moment of my life. However much of it I might have left, I will not waste another moment. And that really was the power of that experience.
It can seem strange and it can seem alien. Do you understand that response? And
have, very much.
Is that the normal response, I suppose, of friends even, when you tell them about this?
Yes. Over the years, I didn't talk about these initiations to anybody. It was something that Kushal encouraged me not to share for a long time. And it really was only after these many years that he eventually said that he felt it was time that if I wished that I could share what I had learnt, whatever it was, that I could share it with others, which is why I decided to brave writing the book. And it did feel as though I required courage to put some of those things into words, very difficult to express, actually, when it's so deep and personal. But my hope is, whilst this is not a book that says you must go out now and blindfold yourself and sit in a dark cupboard for days on your own, what I'm hoping is that the practical teachings, which are applicable to everybody, even within the structure of another religion, and that this doesn't have to go against another's spiritual background or religious belief. I mean, these are really humanist teachings, actually, that he offered. And as I said before, it was their practicality rather than the mysticism of them that I found especially attractive, because they can be explored safely in your own time, in your own life, in the here and now.
I sense great respect for Kushal Magar from you, and the relationship is one that was one of trust, one of mutual respect too.
Yes, very much so.
How would you say your life has changed, you know, sort of in a practical, physical sense, and the spiritual and emotional side of life too?
It changed everything. It has, over time, changed everything. It would probably take a while for me to explore that in detail with you, but the principal thing, I think, is the change in my self-image and self-worth. I had, by the time I actually reached him, I had spent too many years in very deep, dark self-loathing and felt hopeless for myself and hopeless about life in general. Very cynical, really, because of the pain that I had experienced and had actually been inflicted on me for many years. And so all of that changed. He was able, through his teachings and the insights that he gave me, to dismantle that. And I said this before, but being able to recognize first and then resolve the conflicts between my heart, my soul, and the life that I was leading was transformative in itself. But he also enabled me to decide on what is it in my life that enables me to live healthily and freely. And I can say that so simply, but that the magnitude of that realization and applying that to my life was immense and remains immense. Also to learn from him that happiness is actually a choice. And that had never occurred to me and had never been offered to me, that happiness is a choice, irrespective largely of one's background. And this certainly has been highlighted to me with the work that I do. I run a charity in India working with ostracized people. And this is one way that I have been able to turn my own background of isolation and ostracization into something that is positive. So working with people particularly who have been isolated because of leprosy, and to realise that, you know, they've gone through things that I have never experienced and will never experience, the level of abuse and real social ostracisation. And yet there is nowhere in the world that I laugh more than in these leprosy colonies. And these people have been a perfect example to me, and many of them actually come from the hills and are Nepalese speaking. Perfect examples of that fact, that whatever our background, that happiness in the present is a choice. And that in itself was transforming.
Your you're listening to the Sunday Morning Highlights with me, Cathy MacDonald. That was an extract from my interview with writer, physical therapist and explorer of Himalayan mountain traditions, David Charles Manners. Now, the Scottish Government announced last week plans to review the law on succession and inheritance, with a consultation to take place next year. Inheritance is an issue that touches both our heads and our hearts. Is the transfer of wealth between generations an injustice, an access to privileges that would otherwise be beyond reach, leading to wider inequalities in society? Or is it about individual freedom and a very human impulse to pass something on to loved ones? Joining me now to further discuss this is author and journalist Katie Grant. Good morning to you, Katie.
Good morning.
And director of the Beliefs and Values think tank Ecclesia, Simon Barrow. Very warm welcome to you, Simon.
Thank you.
I'll start with you, Simon. Do you think the state should be interfering with inheritance? Because let's face it, people will have their own positions on this, and that can be informed either by religion or from their families. After all, it is your wealth. Should you be the one with the right to choose what to do with it?
Well, I think perhaps the first way of looking at it is to recognise that bequests and inheritances are a personal matter, but they're also a social matter. If we only think about what we pass on to those who are closest to us, we're perhaps not thinking about what kind of world they will inherit. So inevitably it becomes a public issue, and so there's a sort of big debate about whether you tax recipients or whether you tax those who leave the gifts and so on. I think it would be a rather good idea to tax according to the wealth or otherwise of the recipient, because then it's about how you share resources and it isn't simply about hoarding. But it's a personal thing, and perhaps when the state comes into it, the difficulty is it feels rather impersonal. Mm. So one thing, for example, that could be done is that when money does end up going to the state, there could be common good funds for local communities. That might be a way of tying in our corporate interests, if you like, as well as our personal ones.
But of course, some people would not welcome the idea of sharing out with, if you like, the family. And Katie, you can argue that the recipient hasn't earned that wealth, that it's pot luck, and that you're not just passing on wealth, you're also passing on advantage. Some people might even say disadvantage and all the ramifications of that.
Well, you are. I mean, I think we also have to remember that we all do benefit from the state. So the state does have does have some kind of interest in what's handed on. But it does, undoubtedly, it does entrench some advantage, some privilege. But it is a natural human instinct to want to give your children some kind of a financial shelter, if you like, even if it's not a huge financial leg up. And also, you know, try to give them, in these days when everything's so expensive, try and give them something basic, like enough money to put down a deposit for a house. So it's not always just about sort of, I've got sort of hoarding and let's give them lots of stuff. Sometimes it's just about trying to give them something which is useful. So I think in a way we are now thinking about it in the usages of the money. You see lots of grandparents now, for example, trying to help with the university fees. And that seems to me, that's a form of inheritance. But it's a kind of living inheritance, and I think people are more willing to accept that as being right and proper than, you know, suddenly being left in a will £1 million. Although what novelists would do if there wasn't this wonderful sort of thing about the reading of the will, I don't really know.
Yes, for example, the costs of education, or particularly the costs of housing, which are spiralling now, means that a lot of young people or people on lower incomes are finding it very difficult. So sharing resources within families, as you say, in a living way, as well as in wills, is important. And small parcels are helpful to people. The really big problem is that hoarding and speculation and inheritance, that is massive amounts of unearned income, are contributing to very large inequality. So you're talking about huge chunks of money here, because let's not forget Britain is on the way to becoming the third most unequal country in the world at the moment. So that's where the really big issues have to be faced. And maybe we need a change of heart as well as a change of direction.
But
and
it's so entrenched, isn't it, Simon?
Yes.
I mean, for example, it's not just money, is it? I mean, the top sort of 0.0001% leave vast tracts of land to their children, which is passed down, and that also entrenches advantage and privilege. And
yes.
Yet it also preserves some of the things that draw people to this country, you know, wonderful country houses and all that kind of thing. So we have to be careful that we don't swill out the baby with the bathwater. I think it's interesting that a lot of self-made people now are no longer leaving their money to their children. They're specifically saying we're going to cut our children. You know, our children are going to start off like everybody else. Although we never really hear about possible trust funds that are set up, which just in case, you know.
Although I suspect that's because they might view that as a disincentive. And for many people, you would hope that the kind of things they want to pass on to their children would be more than just about money. And there is the argument too, Katie, isn't it, that the benefits of wealth are there while their parents are alive.
Yes, indeed. So you're certainly not going to get rid of inequality by taxing inheritance. As you say, I mean, you know, what the biggest thing you can hand on to your children is aspiration, a can-do attitude, confidence. But money does play a part in that. You know, if you can buy yourself an education, that I think is one of the most crucial things. I'm always interested in the theology, though, because on the one hand we have the parable of the talents. You know, we must go off and make more of ourselves. But it seems to stop there, and then we have to give all our stuff to the poor. So there does seem to be a lesson there in the Bible. But it's quite hard to give stuff completely away, isn't it? If you spent many hours slogging for it, you didn't earn it yourself. So there's a difference, isn't there, between inheritance, which has gone on through generations, and the stuff which, if you have dragged yourself up and you have made the money yourself, then it seems somehow more unfair that it should be taken away from you.
And equally, Simon, we are talking about inheritance with the presumption that everybody has something to pass on. This is not the case.
No.
And this is what we're talking about, the divisions in society. If you want to avoid this increasing gap between the haves and the have-nots, what are the alternatives?
Well, I think what you've said is absolutely right. There are millions and millions of people who have nothing to pass on. And even when we talk about passing on education or enabling people to move into education, it means that some are going to get it and some aren't going to get it. I think the alternative is to take a wider view of these things. So one of the things we're doing on Ecclesia, for example, is helping people to think about what you pass to family and loved ones, but also what you might pass on to your local community, what you might pass on to the global community, and indeed thinking also about the earth and the environment, because all of these things will affect what happens to future generations. So thinking of me and us only is really rather short-sighted. And in terms of redistribution, we heard a moment ago about the parable of the talents. Of course, that's a rather ironic parable, because I think what Jesus is doing there is talking about a corrupt landlord system, and his hearers would have understood that he's not endorsing that. It's rather a critique of it, and all the emphasis on the Gospels is about sharing, because it's important that Christian and Jewish and Muslim traditions all agree that we need to think of ourselves not as the sole owners of the things around us, but rather as stewards. These things are gifts, and what we do with gifts is we pass them on. And it's interesting, even in Wills we talk about worldly goods, and that word goods is quite interesting. It's not product. It's not things, it's about what can actually benefit each other. And so if we begin to think like that, I think we'll take a different view of inheritance and a lot of other things as well. But it's the large parcels of unearned income which certainly really do contribute to inequality, and undoubtedly inheritance is part of that. I'm glad that the Scottish Government is beginning to tackle the very serious land issue in Scotland, and also the law of succession, and I'm glad that there are moves in the direction of changing that.
But is there any of it that is fair, in a sense? Because some would argue, as we've said earlier, that I've earned it, I should have the right to do what I like with it. equally, this, if you like, building up of treasures upon earth, as the Christian perspective of it would be, although that's my taking it literally, if you like. Equally, some people would say, well, people who inherit this through no fault of their own, surely it should be a kind of conscience thing. Would that be fairer? Is it when you introduce laws and taxes that people get kind of quite shirty about getting and having this imposed on them?
They do. I mean, actually, I think the word fair is rather a difficult one, because of course it isn't fair, but life isn't fair. Almost nothing is fair. You know, you're born. That's not fair. You know, you can't choose your family and the place in which you're born. So I think we have to look less at fairness and more what is for the common good. The common good is also a fairness, because we all live in a society, and when society becomes more unequal, it's a very uncomfortable society to live in. So there's a form of fairness which goes beyond just my personal, what I personally feel is fair. It's what is fair in the society in which you live. I think it was interesting that some religions, you know, chose to use a tithe system, and the tithe system was tied in to how much you had. It was a percentage. So we are actually, for generations, for centuries, we've thought of this idea of what should be mine and what should be shared. Because most of what we earn and the money and stuff that we accumulate is in fact not just down to us, it's also down to other people. And it would be very peculiar if you just said, oh, this is mine because I've earned it all by myself. You usually don't really do that. So I think we have to think of fairness in a different kind of way, a broader way than just personal fairness.
And on that question, if you like, of a tithe or tithe system, the ancient Hebrew tradition was it the idea of jubilee, where there was this equalisation of land, property and ownership rights. Can we learn from that?
Yes, I mean, that's a more radical tradition than just a percentage of income or inheritance, because it's about the restoration of land to original owners. It's about the freeing of people from debts, which, of course, in ancient times included slaves, and doing it on a regular basis every 7 or 49 years. It's a little uncertain historically how much this actually happened, but it was an aspiration, and it was based on the idea that what we hold in common. And I agree that fairness is a rather vague idea, but mutual interest, common good, and actually looking to redress the inequalities which harm everyone. They harm the poorest and most vulnerable, but they also trap some individuals in just huge amounts of wealth and an isolated view of the world. So if we can begin to move more towards mutuality in the way that we handle these things, we're all going to benefit.
You've been listening to Highlights from Sunday Morning with Cathy McDonald from BBC Radio Scotland. Thanks for listening.